Right now, on Current State, new concerns that patients will be left out when new medical marijuana guidelines begin.
There needs to be a way to start the new licensed dispensaries and ensure that medicine is obtainable and uninterrupted.
From Lansing to the Capitol.
The state made it very clear that if you stay open, it would be a deterrent to getting a license.
See how the changes could affect thousands across Michigan. Also,
Twitter is an extension of everything. Twitter is part of your brand. It's not something you get to do on the side.
MSU grad and ESPN anchor Jamel Hill makes headlines retweeting about President Trump. Lansing sports hosts weigh in on whether there should be a separation between sports and politics. Plus, a Michigan company plans something never done before underneath the Great Lakes. Hear why everyone may not be on board. From the WKER studios at Michigan State University, this is Current State for September 16th and 17th. Hello and welcome. I'm WKER Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. We start with medical marijuana in Michigan. Between now and January, we're likely to see the most regulation of this industry since voters approved it back in 2008. Lansing has more dispensaries than any Michigan city other than Detroit. But as WKER's Katie Cook reports, many of those facilities must close by the end of the year, leaving some angry and anxious.
Lansing City Council approved a medical marijuana ordinance more than a week ago that sets the cap on the number of dispensaries at 25. With unofficial estimates putting the number of dispensaries in the city as high as 70, this has dispensary owners concerned.
As far as the cap goes, I don't see how that's going to increase access to patients, which is honestly the whole idea behind the act, so I see that as a negative.
Jacob Rufenacht is the owner of Kind Dispensary on Michigan Avenue. He's worried about his patients because he's seen how much medical marijuana helps them.
It's a life-changing drug for them to experience. I mean, I've seen people stop taking 10 different pharmaceuticals and be able to take essentially a 12 and a half milligram dose of medical marijuana and, you know, stop taking all of the pharmaceuticals, relieve all of their symptoms and pain, and go about their life in a normal way with almost zero side effects. I mean, that's as good as it gets in my mind.
His dispensary is situated close to two churches, and this will be a problem for him because of another aspect of the new ordinance, distance regulations. A marijuana dispensary will be required to be at least 1,000 feet from a school and 500 feet from churches, playgrounds, and other dispensaries. Lansing City Council President Patricia Spitzley says dispensaries that aren't in compliance won't be able to stay where they are.
All the facilities, everybody starts at ground zero. So if you're currently operating a dispensary and you're within the setback for a church, you're going to need to find a new location.
Lansing's ordinance has taken years to finalize. And while the debates have drawn out and the different drafts have been written and rewritten, the state of Michigan has been working on its licensing procedures, too. Patricia Spitzley explains that the city ordinance had to line up with these impending state licensing procedures.
When we put together the ordinance, it was important to us as a council that whoever applied for and received a license for a dispensary, we were relatively confident that our requirements were such that, you know, they could go get a state license.
Some examples of what Lansing and the state of Michigan will require of applicants who want licenses are a business plan, a security plan, a plan for disposal of byproducts of marijuana processing, and proof of $100,000 in equity. Now, the city ordinance probably won't go into effect until the state finalizes its licensing structure. The state's Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs, or LARA, says the regulatory framework will be implemented by December 15th. And it warned that any dispensaries that remain open after that date could be taking a risk. Again, Council President Spitzley.
They're saying that you could be at a significant disadvantage. They haven't really said what that disadvantage is going to be, but I think their intent is to make sure all the dispensaries start on a level playing field. And so they want all of them closed before they apply for licenses.
But Jacob Rufenacht says not only can he not afford to close, his patients can't afford for him to.
We are seeing a lot of scared patients, a lot of people wondering where their meds are going to come from, how they're going to get them, and how they're going to get the edibles, the oils, and the things that their caregiver just can't make. Patients are calling us every day, worried that their dispensary or we are going to close. We really have no plans to close unless we are forced to. We're here for the patients.
He understands the need for regulation. He just doesn't think patient access should be jeopardized in the process.
There needs to be a way to start the new licensed dispensaries and ensure that medicine is obtainable and uninterrupted for all of the patients. There's no other way to do it.
But at this point, the state doesn't seem to see it that way. And how that will affect patients remains to be seen. For WKAR, I'm Katie Cook.
Now let's shift to a discussion about medical marijuana across Michigan. It's been 8 years since voters approved cannabis for medicinal purposes, but it's only now that a state board is helping set up regulation. And covering this issue is our Capitol correspondent, Shayna Roth. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So something very important happened this week on this issue.
So the State Medical Marijuana Licensing Board met this week, and actually at the board meeting, the state's licensing department, LARA, had the big announcement. They announced that as of December 15th, if you are a dispensary and you are still operating, you risk not being able to get a medical marijuana license from the state.
And I imagine that drew quite a reaction from the dispensary owners.
Yes, it did. From patients, caregivers, dispensaries, kind of across the board, the pro-marijuana advocates were very frustrated by this. What they were saying was essentially, if you take away these dispensaries, even for, you know, however many months or weeks it could be, that you are, you know, severely cutting off and severely limiting patients' access to medication. The board responded with, we're giving these people, a few weeks, a few months to figure it out and to find a caregiver in the meantime. But even caregivers were stepping up and they were saying, look, I can only grow X amount of plants under the law. And depending on how my crop goes, depending on, a bunch of other factors, I might not have enough marijuana to make up for all of the dispensaries that are going to have to close. And one woman made an interesting point. She is a patient, but she's also a caregiver herself. She said, depending on my crop, depending on a couple other factors, I sometimes can't even supply for the patients that I currently have. So what I end up having to do is refer them to dispensaries. And if they don't have those dispensaries to go to, they are going to be, they're not going to have that medication that they need.
Will cities like Lansing, who are making their own ordinances, be affected by the state's rules?
Yes. Essentially, what the board is trying to do is it's trying to, sort of even the playing field and to make the rules the same for everybody. So even if you're a dispensary, say, in Lansing that has these types of ordinances, unless those dispensaries close their doors by December 15th, they could risk not getting a license by the board. It's not a guarantee. The board could still decide, we're going to give you a license anyway. But the state made it very clear that this could, that if you stay open, it would be a deterrent to getting a license.
You were a former prosecuting attorney. How difficult was it to make sure everyone was playing by the same rules, especially when you got into court cases?
It was very difficult. Several years ago, when the Medical Marijuana Act first came out and it legalized marijuana in very specific circumstances, there were a lot of different details that in some cases were covered and in some cases were not. So you had issues like, if I am a medical marijuana card holder, but my card is expired, and the police, come into my home and find my medical marijuana plants, what happens to me then? Or if you're a patient and you're driving and you have some medical marijuana in your system, what then? So really what would happen is, depending on what judge you got, what court you were in, the penalties could be very different. The decisions on whether a case should go forward or not would be very different. So one of the things that this board seeks to do is to kind of clear up some of that ambiguity and to really kind of put a clean slate out there and to really level everything out and say that, these are the requirements in order to, say, have a dispensary or to be to grow medical marijuana and be a caregiver. This is the license that you have to have, and to sort of really try and make sure that everybody knows exactly what the rules are. And one of those rules is getting a license.
So what are we looking at next as far as the state board?
Well, the state board is still really trying to figure out what the application process is going to be. And what Laura, the State Department, has said is that, you know, that's kind of on them. They're the ones that are going to be coming up with these rules. The board is really there to act in an advisory capacity and to actually sit down with the applications and decide who gets one and who doesn't. But in the meantime, you know, Laura has to figure out, like, okay, what kind of a background check do people need to go through? What requirements do they have to meet in order to get a license? And it seems very clear at this point that they're not going to have definitive forever rules by December 15th. What they're going to do is they're going to enact what are called emergency rules. And those are basically temporary application process and temporary rules. And they're going to kind of go from there and figure out, okay, you know, this rule works, this rule doesn't, and they can kind of, you know, shape it along the way until they finally figure out this is the process, these are the rules that work best for our state.
Thank you, Shayna, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
We have an entire section dedicated to marijuana in Michigan on WKAR.org. It includes a map of where the dispensary locations are clustered, to discussions about how marijuana can help opioid users, as well as viewpoints of people for and against the full legalization of marijuana in our state. Just go to WKER.org. She's no shrinking violet. We're talking about Jemel Hill, a graduate of Michigan State University and host at ESPN, who tweeted this week, quote, "Donald Trump is a white supremacist who has largely surrounded himself with other white supremacists." Later, she tweeted, "My regret is that my comments and the public way I made them painted ESPN in an unfair light." In a statement, ESPN said Hill had a right to her personal opinions, but, quote, "not to publicly share them on a platform that implies that she was in any way speaking on behalf of ESPN." As you can imagine, there was a flood of response, including this from White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
"I think that's one of the more outrageous comments that anyone could make, and certainly something that I think is a fireable offense by ESPN.
So today in Current State, we're exploring sports commentary with some voices and names that you may know well. Joining me in studio is Al Martin, current sports host on WKAR, also Graham Couch, sports columnist with the Lansing State Journal. And on the phone is Rico Beard, host of Spartan Beat with Rico Beard on Team 92.1 FM in Lansing. Welcome to all of you.
How you doing, Ray?
It's good to be here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start with you, Al. You actually talked with Jemel a couple of years ago about sharing opinions.
Yeah, this was back in 2014. And, you know, we had actually Jemel on Current Sports TV the weekend of Michigan State's homecoming. Her colleague at the time, Bill Simmons, who's now with HBO, Bill was suspended due to making comments about Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner. And I asked Jemel, how do you balance keeping it real while also, you know, being mindful that there is a line that you don't want to cross? And here's a bit of what she had to say.
"We're all professionals. I mean, and look, I've been suspended before, all right? So I was suspended in 2007. It was for something I wrote, not necessarily something I said on air.
Okay.
And I think what people have to understand is that it's not necessarily learning to edit yourself, learning how to have responsible opinions. That's not you keeping it any less real. It's just that you have to understand there's certain conversations that are great and sound good among your friends, mm-hmm. but ain't meant for TV.
When it comes to big personalities on ESPN, I mean, opinion is driving a lot of the conversation, right? ESPN has been known and has been praised by many on-air personalities, you know, from the past. And when you hear those personalities talk about how they've been allowed to be themselves on the air, allowed to push the envelope, allowed to be a big voice, big, brash, and honest at the same time. But when you look at the situation now with Jemel, I mean, this is a bit different because it deals with politics. And we all know, living in 2017, it is a very touchy topic here, especially with the election of our president, Donald Trump. But when you come out and say something like this, I think you have to be mindful that, hey, you are a personality, you're a public figure, and anything that you say on social media is going to be scrutinized. So I'm kind of conflicted on it, to be honest. But Graham, for you, because I'm always mindful, whatever I put out on Twitter, I know that I'm not just representing Al Martin. I'm representing WKAR. Mm-hmm. So it's a very touchy topic. It really is.
It is. And I know the Donald Trump situation is touchy for a lot of people. I have a friend who teaches civics and government over at Grand Ledge High School. And this election and this president has been different than anything he's dealt with before, because he's always been careful, you know, when you've had, you know, Mitt Romney or John McCain or whatever. It's different than that, right? And at a certain point, he told me, you can't insult these kids. You have to call a spade a spade. And so he's dealt with that and figured out how he was going to approach it. And I think it's hard for, because we do have a divided country politically. But Trump is a little different. He's on one edge of that divide and has an audience. And the fact that he has such a large audience, I think to some people is pretty scary. But you have to call a spade a spade. I mean, if you can look at his behavior over the last month and argue what she said is absolutely correct. But she also works for somebody. And she is paid a lot of money to represent the entire company on a huge platform at 6 p.m. So she's got to understand what that is. This, you know, you can't just have your own... I mean, Twitter is an extension of everything. Twitter is part of your brand. It's not something you get to do on the side, and there's no repercussions for it, as our president is figuring out, right? So,
well, Graham, if I could interrupt you for 1 second, I would say this, that as far as Jamel, I think the rules have changed, guys. You know, people used to be more diplomatic about it. You actually cared about how other people felt about it, and if you crossed the line, you apologized. Nobody apologizes for anything nowadays, and I think Jamel has kind of gotten ahead of the curve and said, you know what, this is how things are. This is how this one side, you know, talks, so I'm gonna come at you in the same way that you come at me, and I'm going to say things that you may not agree with, but I'm going to say it in the exact same way that you do it.
Are the rules any different because you also have a president who has said different things, whether in the campaign trail or on Twitter himself? He has, in some people's minds, crossed a line in some of the things that you've probably never heard a president of the United States say.
You know what, Reggie? I think it does make the rules different because of that, because you have a president who's bold enough to come out and say whatever it is he wants to say. He doesn't backtrack. He doesn't apologize. He'll, you know, attack people. He'll attack individuals. He'll attack anything that he wants. Whereas before, you would have, you know, presidents say, hey, I don't support this group of people. Hey, I'm not down with these people. They may have voted for me, but that's not my way of thinking. Whereas instead, he just kind of shrugs his shoulders and says, you know what, I won, and I did it by any means necessary.
Yeah, it's kind of the same conversation that we had, you know, when Charlottesville happened. You heard this dialogue about white supremacist groups across this nation that felt comfortable now in coming out and holding their own forums and holding their own protests because they have a president that in many ways has allowed it to be okay based on his ideas and what he said throughout his campaign and throughout the preliminary stages of his presidency.
Let me ask you about this. A few months ago, sports columnist Terry Fry was fired from the Denver Post newspaper after he tweeted his disapproval of a Japanese driver winning the Indy 500 on Memorial Day weekend. So is that different?
Yeah, absolutely different. Because she basically, there is lots of information. I mean, we always say the best columns are reporting-based columns, right, based on facts. There are facts to support what Jamel said. You know, whether we know 100% how he feels, we don't. But there is evidence to back up what she said. And the behavior that's been inappropriate, a lot would argue, is on the president's side and not hers. Whereas the flip side of the Denver Post columnist was an offhanded racial remark. I mean, that had nothing. The driver had nothing to do with that. So yeah, they're very to me they're very different situations.
Yeah, I would agree with Graham. I think that for the Denver writer, it was more an opinion. Whereas Jamel is kind of based on fact. You can fact check and see different things that has happened under the Trump administration or just things that he said even beforehand that can validate what Jamel put out there. Now, as I often tell my listeners, you know what? You may not like what I said, but tell me where I'm wrong. And I would say to people, tell me where Jamel was wrong. You may not like what she said, but was she wrong? That's the difference.
There are people who are calling for her to be fired. So, Rico, I'll start with you. Do you think that will happen?
No, I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think the ESPN wants to go down that road, especially seeing how many people are in support of her? And once again, Reg, it's not like she went out there and gave an opinion that was not based in fact. I think the repercussions for ESPN would be dramatic, because then it would seem as if you just buckled under pressure and it was a knee-jerk reaction. I think for ESPN, you know what? I hate to say this, business-wise, you just milk this, because now you're going to have people watching her just to say how much they can't stand her on the six. So if you're ESPN, no, you do not fire her.
Graham?
Yeah, I don't think, just from a corporation standpoint, it's smart now, because I think the overwhelming sentiment is with her. And from what's a right and wrong thing, you don't. It's just not, even if it's against, you know, I don't know what's in her contract, but there might be certain stipulations. Even if she technically did something that went over the line of her contract, to me, in terms of what's right and wrong, it just sends a really dreadful message if, given, is what Rico just said, and we've been talking about. I mean, this isn't just some flippant opinion. She's not the first person to say it. She's just somebody with a platform saying it based on what we've watched over the last month and beyond.
Yeah, I think it was sending the wrong message, totally. And, you know, I just imagine, you know, if they were to let go Jamel, the amount of backlash that they would have. I mean, they'll have protests outside of, you know, outside of Bristol if that happened, right? And her following and looking at social media, the backing that she has now. I mentioned how many people have come out, and even some of her colleagues at ESPN have come out and supported her. If they let her go, this will be a very bad look for ESPN, which is already, I mean, in the last 3 years, they've lost, what, over 3.1 million subscribers. They just fired or let go 100 employees. 70 of those were on-air talent. This would have a horrible ripple effect if I think they let go Jamel Hill.
Thank you guys for joining us. We're talking with WKER current sports host Al Martin, Graham Couch, columnist with the Lansing State Journal, and Rico Beard, host of Spartan Beat with Rico Beard on Team 92.1 FM in Lansing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having
Thanks
us.
For having me.
What's wrong with being confident? Uh-huh. What's wrong with being? What's wrong with being? What's wrong with being? It's time to get the chains out.
The police officer severely wounded in a knife attack earlier this summer at Bishop International Airport in Flint was honored this week by the Michigan House of Representatives. Lieutenant Jeff Neville was stabbed in the neck by 49-year-old Amor Fatoui, a Canadian of Tunisian descent. WKER's Kevin Lavery met Lieutenant Neville just after a short ceremony at the state capitol, and we got an update about his very public recovery.
I feel pretty good, Kevin. You know, the healing has gone well. Still tossing a few things around in my head, but really I feel surprisingly good.
I'm glad to hear that. What was in your head on June 21st? What were you thinking as it was happening?
Disbelief at first, then I guess just survival. I knew that we had to take him down and control him. And that's really what we tried to do, and it happened very fast, and we did get him under control very quickly.
Well, your voice sounds great. Are you as fully functional today as you were before?
Yeah, I've got a little numbness on the right side of my face, but other than that, I'm good to go.
What has your life been like in the last 3 months? Not just the emotional and physical recovery, but the reception you're getting from your fellow Michiganders.
That has been really fantastic. So many people have told me that they've been praying for me, and I tell them to please keep it up. Because I'll tell you, I felt like I had a wall of prayers around me, and it's just been really great support shown by people. I've been in several events. I've been asked to be involved with different things like the Hurley Trauma Center golf outing. I was just the golf ambassador on Monday. Tomorrow night is hero night at the Fenton football game. I'll be a hero for one of the team players. Just things like that. It's really been good, and I'm glad to do it. I'll do whatever I can to try to be a positive force in the community.
I found God on the corner of First and Amistad, where the West was all but one.
We've got more current state coming up, including a new book examining sexual assaults on college campuses and how to stop them, and a Michigan company's first of its kind plan for the Great Lakes.